Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs. Here are your hosts, Julie Fudge-Smith and Colleen Pilar.
Hi, and welcome to Your Family Dog. I'm Julie Fudge-Smith, and I'm here today, of course, with Colleen Pilar and Dr. Leanne Lilly, who is a veterinarian at The Ohio State University. She is doing her residency in behavior medicine. She got her vet degree at the University of Wisconsin. She returned to Colorado and did some general practice there, and then went to the University of Pennsylvania to do some further research and work in veterinary medicine. And she is in the second year of her three-year residency, which is then followed by one horrific exam, from what I understand. And then she will be one of the few select board-certified veterinary animal behaviorists. And if you listened to our podcast with Dr. Sin, you'll know that there are only about 70 in the United States, Canada, and Australia combined. So we're very excited to have Dr. Lilly here, and she's going to talk to us today about puppies. We're going to do a two-part series. The first one's going to be on puppy development, what we need to know about puppies, and the second one's going to be some warning signs of puppies. So, Colleen, do you have the first question for Dr. Lilly?
I do. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Lilly. My first question on puppy development is, are puppies truly blank slates? So is it really just like they all come out the same and then it's what we do to them?
Oh, that's such a great question, Colleen. I wish that it was true, because I think then we would all feel like we had much more control over our little bundles of fur that we get for such great, joyous reasons. But just like humans aren't completely blank slates, neither are puppies. And the wide variety in dogs is probably bigger than in humans in terms of output capabilities, right? There are certain things that a German Shepherd can do that a Yorkshire Terrier just can't do. So some of that will change their behaviors if they're physically incapable of doing those things. But there are actually a lot of contributing factors that go into who a puppy is and who they'll become that happen before we come into the picture and before we're born, for better or for worse.
Okay, so what you're saying is that this blank slate is not just genetics, it's also maternal environment, correct? So the internal in utero environment has an influence on behavior?
Yes, it does. So there are studies in most species, except actually dogs and cats, that show that prenatal stress has a profound impact on the behavior of the offspring. We actually have studies for that in humans, but not in dogs. But that's okay. We won't induce a bunch of stress in dogs just to find out the answer to that question. We know it pretty much works the same. Yes, we don't like to induce stress. But that can lead to sort of increased emotionality. And you can think about it as sort of having a set point, right? So your emotional response and your stress and your anxiety, they're all responses to the environment, and they have a stress point, and they have a sort of a turn off point. And if during development they're constantly flooded by the things that are supposed to say, oh, hey, we can turn off that response, that set point's not going to be in the same place as if it wasn't flooded with those types of signals.
Right. So, for example, if the mother is under a great deal of stress and is producing a lot of cortisol because she's under stress, what kind of effect is that going to have on the puppies postnatal?
So we talk about it as sort of a high emotionality as kind of a blanket statement. But really what happens is that stress response off put or off switch gets adjusted, and it's because of negative feedback. So what should happen during a stress response is your brain says, ooh, we have a stress response. We need to respond to this. Let's release some cortisol. And it sends signals to the adrenal glands, and the adrenal glands secrete cortisol, which if you happen to be a human being, we're all very focused on why it's not so good for our immune system or in our long-term health and our mood or our midsection. So we're starting to become more and more familiar with cortisol, but it's good to be able to turn it off. So you should have a stress response, and then the presence of cortisol gets back up to the brain. The hypothalamus says, oh, okay, we responded. We can turn that off now. And so that feedback mechanism gets altered. So what happens is they get flooded with the maternal cortisol, and puppy brain go, oh, okay, I guess there was a stress response. Well, everything in here seems okay. We can turn that off. And their adrenal glands say, we didn't do anything. puppy brain goes, well, that must be normal. Okay. Adjust my set point. And if that happens repeatedly or for prolonged periods, you can get really significant changes in what that set point is for that puppy. Then when that puppy has a stress response, that response can look very, very abnormal or very, very kind of excessive, right? Because what it takes for their brain to say, ah, yes, we responded to that stressor, we can turn it off now, is more than a puppy who didn't go through that prenatal environment.
Okay. So what kind of, what would you be seeing then as far as a behavior? So for example, say you're out walking your puppy and somebody comes around the corner with another dog who then goes woof at your puppy. And so your puppy's startled. A normal puppy might go, oh, it's another dog, and back up, but then go, oh, it's okay. But a dog whose stress reaction is much higher, what kind of a response would you perhaps see from a dog like that who gets startled?
So you can take what you would normally see and you can multiply it and you can add in other things to it. So they might do that initial, oh, yep, something scary. And instead of going, oh, that's a dog. Right, I'm a dog too. You get this pervasive response. So pulling away, cowering, rolling over, urinating, spinning around the owner, which if you've ever had happen to you, is a great experience for you and the puppy when you trip and fall on the puppy, yes. Adding more stress to the environment. So we can see those types of behaviors amplified. And then they also may not recover as quickly, right? So instead of going, oh, you're a dog and I'm a dog too, it's, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And 20 minutes later down on the walk, they're still looking over their shoulder. They're crunched down. They're hunched up. They look still nervous. And the dog that came around the corner went, woof, has long since passed. So their recovery time can also be altered.
So that's good to see. So what you're saying is it's sort of an excessive, as most people would think in terms of fight or flight, that this dog is not just, whoa, stepping back, but whoa, trying to tear away. So you're seeing a really enhanced fight, flight, freeze response from the dog.
You are. You're more likely to see those responses. You can also see other stress-related behaviors that we don't sort of think about as being that startle. So there's things like excessive busyness. I have to have something to do all the time because I don't know what to do with myself. I'll call those displacement behaviors. But we all sort of, like, we know a human being like that. We all kind of know a puppy like that, like, must have a toy, must have a toy. What are we doing now? What are we doing now? What are we doing now? We can see those increase. We can see things like pacing increase. And see responses to sort of small changes in the environment result in big changes in behavior, right? You move the couch, suddenly the living room, the entire living room has to be reinvestigated. Didn't necessarily cower, but like, we got to make sure it's okay now because the couch is in a different spot. And so we can see all of those behaviors amplified or changed potentially.
That's so- my cat. I had a pair of socks in the middle of the bedroom floor and he walked in, froze, stalked over, sniffed, looked offended, walked around, came back, and then went, oh, it's socks. So small changes in environment.
Small changes in environment. Everything. Big, much bigger than normal emotional response.
Yeah.
Okay. So so that would be a warning sign to me that if I'm walking along and my puppy goes, wow, I can't handle the sight of another dog, I'm going to, you know, dive underneath the car that's parked next to the curb, or I am going to be excessively barked, that would be a warning sign to me that something is seriously wrong. So can you perhaps give us an idea of what some of the warning signs would be that your puppy is not going the way you think it ought to go? What would be some minor warning signs, and perhaps what would be some major warning signs? And you know, does it matter, like, for example, if my dog reacts that way at 8 weeks, should I be concerned? Will he grow out of it? Or if he reacts this way at 16 weeks, is that more concerning, or at 6 months?
That's a nice big hard question.
Yeah, it is.
That's it is a nice big hard question. I'm sorry. We can break that down.
Let's see if I can break it down into bite-sized chunks and digest
okay.
them. So one thing, overall, so when are things more concerning? It depends a little bit on when they're more normal. So that's complicated. But I would say that I'm really, really concerned the younger a puppy is, the more intense either a fear, an avoidance, or heaven forbid, an aggressive response are seen. Because they're not something that they are likely to outgrow kind of on their own or organically. We can certainly help them do that. We can help a lot of puppies who start off worried about the world decide, oh, the world is not so bad. It means peanut butter and cream cheese, but it may not happen just on its own. And so the younger they are, I'm more worried. And maybe that's because I'm like, oh, now's the time to do something. So I'm worried from an interventional standpoint, for sure. I'm also worried about if that puppy continues to experience the world that way, especially in that very critical young time frame from about ages 3 weeks to 12 weeks. And most of us aren't interacting with puppies that young. We tend to get them at 8 weeks of age. But that's that socialization period where they are in the business of deciding how the universe works during that time frame. And they're sort of big job is to take experiences and things, sights, sounds, people, dogs, places, and decide, are you an opportunity? Oh, this could be fun. Are you neutral? I don't care about the sound of the toaster. Or are we a potential threat or an actual threat? Like, well, I'm not okay with this. This is scary, right? So those are the three main categories that they're busy putting the world into during that time frame. And if they're seeing things as being that scary during that time frame, then that's going to inform their perceptions for the rest of their life. So I find that very worrisome.
When you're talking about how extreme a response is, let's say we're talking about a younger puppy, you know, the 8 to 10 weeks old, in terms of, okay, we've had a startle response, how quickly would you expect to see bounce back if we're thinking it's a good sign versus, oh dear, this is a puppy who might have a little bit of a different high emotionality or a different set point for some of this?
Sure. So if it's something that's just sort of surprising and isn't persistent, right? So it's that single dog goes woof and then the dog, say, moves on and moves away, right? We should see recovery pretty quickly, right? The incident itself is over. So it should be like, oh, okay, all right, moving on. Go find some sniffing. And if it's a little bit longer than that, we would like to be able to see that we can encourage them to recover faster by the use of things that they enjoy. A toy, a treat, getting their attention with a happy voice, and they go, oh, Wiggly, okay, whatever's going on over there is more exciting than the thing that I was just worried about. Those things are okay to see in terms of, you know, small amounts and not being a persistent pattern. Like if your puppy startles once when you drop the pan in the kitchen, like that's kind of normal. But if your puppy startles every time somebody drops anything, like you drop a pen, you close a door, you all those little sounds that are kind of day-to-day, not high volume, then I'd be worried about it. Or you do a medium intensity thing, right? You drop something that's slightly loud. We all drop our cell phones. That's probably a good medium volume indicator. And your puppy yelps like it's been stepped on. Then I'm a little worried about that, right? That's sort of a disproportionate response. It seems like it's really, really intense, and we'd like to see the recovery be very, very quick, but also that it's not persistent.
So my question is if this is happening in a relatively young puppy, let's say a puppy who's 8 weeks old, which is pretty young about the time most of us are getting our puppies. So we see this excessive response to a dropped cell phone. And the person's only had the dog for a day or two, right? When is that? So they haven't, obviously, it's nothing that they've done to make this dog fearful because they've only had the puppy for a day or two. Now, is this something that the puppy can overcome, or is this something that's more strongly genetically based, which is going to be a lot more difficult to overcome? Or what's the, I guess my question is how concerned should somebody be that this is something that we can work on?
Sure. Well, so that precious time period when we, you know, get a young puppy until the socialization period starts to close, so that 8 to 10 week period is actually the best time to start working on something. That's when you're the most likely to have success because their brain is sort of like Play-Doh because its whole job is to decide if something is safe or scary. And if we get in there and we interject, oh no, this is really fun. Oh, this is really fun. This is really fun. Then that puppy's going to be able to shift that from, no, it's scary. No, really, it's scary. Much better than at 16 weeks of age, 6 months of age, a year of age. So earlier intervention makes things go much, much, much better. And it's also easier. They also generalize it. So maybe it's, so you drop the cell phone and your puppy is, whoa, really worried. Well, do you want to sit around and find out if all other noises are scary? Or maybe you just teach the puppy right then, P.S., noises are actually awesome. Because if you just make that assumption and you teach them that, then they're going to generalize that to the next time they hear a different new noise that they didn't encounter that's of the same intensity. Because that's that's their brain's job during that time frame.
Okay. And so the same thing would go towards introducing them to a variety of people. So that if you're walking down the street and your kid or your dog sees some strollers and kids, and that's always paired with cheese or pepperoni or whatever, then they're going to start to generalize about children. And then some big tall man with a hood, you know, a hooded sweatshirt comes by, and he also means that I get a whole lot of cheese. Then the dog is going to begin to understand that people, no matter what their size, shape, or age, are something that I should be anticipating as a good thing because it means my owner has malfunctioned and liver happens.
Yes, yes. That is exactly the special nature of this period. The problem is if you try to do it later, you don't get that generalization. So you may see a stroller and a child and go, and the dog may learn that stroller and that child mean cheese, but the next child and the next stroller isn't going to inherently mean I should expect something fun to happen if you work on this outside of the socialization period. Inside the socialization period, they're pre-programmed to wipe out bad experiences with more positive good ones and then create that pervasive generalization.
Okay. And so the same thing then would be, and this is something that you yourself can generalize in your dog's experiences. So it's not just with kids or people, but it's also with substrates. So we're going to walk on gravel and grass and wood chips and tarmac and cement and all those things so that we learn that substrates are good. And we're going to see cats in windows. And if we, we're going to try and meet other dogs in a positive way. So what happens, though, if the dog has like a negative response to other dogs? Is it just the same kind of thing that whenever we see a dog, we get all kinds of chicken and liver and hamburger and all that kind of stuff?
Well, that's certainly a good place to start, this baseline of, ooh, just encountering this at a distance means something yummy. It can also be, it's really important that we make sure that when we are encountering or our puppies are encountering these things, that we're starting them from a level where they're not already overtly afraid. I mean, accidents happen, right? Dogs walk around the corners and startle us. Bicycles fly out of nowhere. And we want to respond to those in a way that say, oh, that wasn't as bad as we thought. But we also don't want to say, well, you know, I'm just going to put my puppy down in the middle of a swarm of dogs and that'll make everything go okay. Because we need to make sure the puppy's having a good time when we expose them to those things, or we're kind of doing the wrong thing. We're actually potentially making them fearful of those situations. The problem is it's hard to necessarily control how the other dog behaves. So you have to pick dogs that you can predict how they're going to behave. So either dogs that you know, or dogs that your trainer knows, or other puppies in a puppy class with well-seasoned monitoring of their body language and well-paired, right? A puppy free-for-all with a Yorkie, four German Shepherds, and a Corgi might not go well for that Yorkie, right? Like, ooh.
Yeah.
That's a pain-induced fear waiting to happen, and not necessarily because any of those dogs are inappropriate in any way, but, you know, a little tiny nose bump from a German Shepherd puppy the same age as a Yorkshire puppy is sort of like, I don't know, getting flung across the room. So we have to carefully engineer those experiences to be positive and to start at levels where they're already okay and then build them even better.
Right. And which brings me to the point, too, is that if you don't know if your puppy is proceeding normally or not, one of the good things I think to do is to find yourself a really good puppy class. And I know that the Ohio State University offers a wonderful one. I've taken my own dogs through your puppy class. And what I found is that it's really valuable to get somebody's eyes on the puppy who really knows what they're doing. And also, too, to see what my puppy acts like in a safe environment, exposed to a wide variety of things. When we took Bear, our burner, through it, there was a little, I think it was a little border collie. Might have been an Aussie. Doesn't really matter. But anyway, who was just more timid than he probably should have been. And I don't think the owners knew that until they got him into a puppy class. And he started interacting with the other puppies and realizing that, wow, he was kind of fearful. But the woman who ran the class did a really great job of managing the environment and managing the dog so that puppy did not get overwhelmed. That puppy, the other puppies may be on leash, and that puppy was let loose to pick a playmate. and then they mm-hmm. could play. And then when yep. we did dog-to-dog greetings, she chose our bear to do it because bear is so food motivated. He was just so much more interested in the chicken that dad had than he was in overwhelming this little Aussie. So he would like kind of look at the Aussie and like, hey, yeah, hey, but my dad has chicken, so I'm going over here. So it was a really, I think it's really important for puppy classes, not just to provide sort of the beginning exposure to obedience, but to get somebody's trained eyes on your dog so that if there are problems, they can be seen, they can be addressed earlier rather than later.
Absolutely. And I think for those of us, you know, for your average dog owner, you probably haven't met thousands of puppies. And so until you've met thousands of puppies, your basis for comparison is a couple of things. And there's enough variation in behavior that you may miss things, overlook things, and have lots of questions too. And I think there's nothing worse than proceeding as if things are going normal when they're not, or vice versa, being really worried that something is a problem for a long period of time, only to have someone tell you, oh, that's okay, that's normal. And you just lost all that time worrying. So I think right. it's valuable from both sides, especially for the puppy parent.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, if you were to list, for example, if you were to warning signs for puppies, if you were to give like yellow warning signs, ones that probably need some attention, but they're not overly serious, versus red warning signs, like you really need to get your puppy seen by somebody. Could you provide us with a bit of a list there?
Sure. So avoidance, sort of mild avoidance, or people often will describe them as shy or hesitant. So these are those puppies that will approach something, but they approach it like they're kind of approaching it and they're checking it out and they're slow and they may be low and it takes them a little time, versus what we think of as kind of your quintessential goofy puppy that's just like a thing, I'm going to wiggle on over to that thing, right? Yeah. So when we start to see that avoidance or that hesitance to approach, that's kind of a yellow flag, like at the level of will still approach, but maybe a little tentative. Startle responses that are happening in response to sort of day-to-day things. Those are things like if they're mild, right? Just a little shoulder hunch. Those are things where we probably just need to have that evaluated and start working on. And situations where we maybe are seeing that they are withdrawn. If I'm seeing a puppy that seems really calm or really withdrawn, I want to know why. If it's because they just played and they're about to pass out and take a nap, well, that's okay. But if that's how the puppy is all the time, I want to make sure that that's not because they're looking at the world and going, I don't feel safe interacting with any of this, I'm just going to stay right here. So those withdrawn are those really calm puppies. Because a normal puppy should be squirmy, they should be wiggly, right? It's all those things we really kind of like about them. So we want to see, right, it's like the joyous, giggly parts of the puppy. We want to make sure that we're seeing those. And then anything which is sort of a small deviation for those are those yellow flags. So again, that hesitance or that shyness, especially in that age, doesn't, you know, again, it's not a, ooh, panic attack moment, but we want to make sure that we're working on that puppy. We're saying, ah, you need a little extra support in making your positive aspect associations about the universe.
And those are all subtle enough that I think most people don't recognize them because they explain them away as, oh, he's a baby. You know, like, yep. Oh, the fact that he's avoiding that, well, it's just because he's a baby. He's never seen that before. Or he got startled because he's never seen that before or heard that. Or he's so calm because, you know, he's just starting. And all of those pieces aren't in the typical puppy, but they're easy to kind of explain away, which, again, when we talk about having a good puppy class, I think we all have a little bit of rose-colored glasses on about our own dog because we love them. And so we tend to see the behavior absolutely. In the best light. So
absolutely.
That behavior that looks calm to you might look withdrawn to me.
And that's another value of having someone else look at your puppy, right? It's just somebody else to say, do they always do that? To ask those questions. And maybe that you end up coming to the same conclusion at the end of that conversation, but it's a good conversation to have and a good basis for comparison. Of course, the opposite is true too. If you have a puppy who never stops moving and is practically vibrating, that puppy may also need a little bit of support.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
So if we were looking at puppies still in this young age, say, you know, 8 to 12 or 13 weeks, what would be some red warning signs? Like, oh my gosh, that is so not typical for a puppy in this age.
Yeah, so red warning signs would be that sort of full-on-out panic response to most things that aren't painful. So, you know, you close the door or there's nothing that's like overtly loud. Like the smoke detector goes off for the first time. You're going to want to manage that afterwards. But like it's shrill. It's designed to be aversive. Like that's just, your puppy should startle in response to that. But sort of normal day-to-day sounds, we don't want to see a really, really profound response. We don't want to see shrieking. We don't want to see yelping in response to those types of situations. We don't want to see refusal to approach things or hiding. Hiding behavior suggests that a dog is afraid, right? You have a puppy underneath a piece of furniture in the corner. That is a puppy I'm very worried about.
Yes.
And then the other thing that I worry about is, again, sort of the reverse is sort of the alarm bark. Like it's oftentimes medium to high pitch, but they sound pretty distressed about it, whether that's at a person, at another dog, when they're in their crate, that's a sound of distress. And we need to ask ourselves, why are we distressed and how do we help them out of it? Those can often escalate. Anytime you see hackles going up on a puppy, I'm worried.
Okay.
That's sort of one of our most subtle signs of aggression. That's a profound level of arousal that should be reserved for a little bit later in life.
Okay.
How about growling? That's often reserved for later in life too. When would you expect to see growling?
Well, we do often see a little bit of play growling and grunting in younger puppies, and especially some really interesting mouthing with those puppy teeth of sharp needle doom. So if they're playing and the dog is wiggly and, right, they have that quintessential derpy retriever motion where head's moving in relation to the shoulders, shoulders moving in relation to the rump, tail's moving in relation to that, and they're rolling over each other and their mouths are staying open, but they're going, ah, rah, 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 rah. People will call that a play growl. I know my impression of dog sounds is amazing. And that's okay. That's normal. But if we're seeing low growls, growls followed by barks and yips, so rah, right? Rah, those are sounds that we don't want to see those in puppies that age. And that doesn't mean that we, you know, inhibit them or we tell the puppy that that's wrong. But that means that puppy's in a state that an emotional state that doesn't predispose them to having great success later in those same situations.
So you mentioned a really good point too about that. We don't want to inhibit these per se. We want to change the emotional state. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think a lot of behavior from a puppy parent standpoint, it's very focused on how do we get these puppies to grow up and to be the puppies that we want them to be, and fully support that. They do need to be, you know, functional members of society, as it were. But the way that we achieve that, the most effective way to achieve that and the safest way to achieve that is to make sure that their emotional input about the situations that we put them in is either neutral to positive. And the reason for that is that you will get the same output that you want. So say you don't want your dog to growl or bark at strangers, right? Or your puppy to do that. If you simply just tell your dog, no, 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 you may or may not inhibit that behavior, but you certainly didn't change their opinion about visitors. And so what we can see is that behavior either often resurfaces or it just gets worse because they still have that same internal motivation, right? I don't want you to come in. I feel threatened by you. I don't want you to come in. I feel threatened by you. Where the reverse being, if you change their emotional response to those situations, right? Visitors aren't scary. Visitors mean playing fetch and finding cheese in a Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Visitors aren't scary. Visitors mean, right? There's no reason to escalate to the output behavior that we don't want.
Because if it does escalate, it's so much harder to turn around. If you getting these dogs who are 2 and 3 years old and they can't function with strangers, they either shut down completely or they become aggressive. At that point, it's so much harder to change things around for them. So it's far better to take a look at this early. The other thing I was going to ask you about too are more like serious puppies. We got a dog once that was just serious. Now, granted, she was a border collie, so she was probably reading Dickens, you know, on the weekends, but
or rewiring the house. One of the
yeah,
two.
Yeah, right. But she was just really serious about everything, and she also and the key that really scared us was she would resource guard anything from our other dogs, like a bowl of water. Or she would, we took her to a puppy class and she resource guarded a rawhide chew from another dog across the room. So I wanted you to address the idea perhaps of, and she was really serious about this, and I was going to keep it. And so, I mean, she didn't have the same kind of puppy wiggle you were talking about, but I also wanted to ask you about resource guarding and whether that's something that people should be take seriously in a puppy.
Yeah, so good question. So the serious puppy, or there's just sort of the puppies that don't have that kind of wiggle, I certainly worry about. And if it's context specific, then you work on that context. And if it's all the time, I'd say, you know, certainly seek professional intensive help. For resource guarding, we do sometimes see that earlier than other types of aggressive behaviors, but certainly in a young puppy, and we're talking about those really young, like 4 months and younger type puppies, that's not normal. And so the question is, why do they think that their food, their bone, their water, their whatever is at a threat from either all the other things, beings in the world, or specific beings? And that's something that you have to be careful about how you work on it, because a lot of effort that people put in to try and either prevent it or work on making it better can actually in turn make it worse. But certainly if it's pervasive to the point where, right, that dog across the room is a threat to the rawhide bone that I have over here, and that dog's not even looking at you, like that dog needs some help to make sure that it feels that it and its stuff is safe in the world so that it can have a happy life. So those are things that I certainly do worry about. On the topic of resource guarding, I do sort of always talk people through their experiences at restaurants. And so if you really wanted to make sure that somebody didn't feel like their food was threatened at a restaurant, you wouldn't walk up to them as the waitress, pick up the dish, and hand it back to them over and over again. Pretty soon the waitress comes up to the table and you're like, nope, you know, put your arms around it, you're going to hunch over it. You're really intense, or you're really hungry, you might get your fork and be like, you're not taking the plate away this time. However, if every time the waitress walks by, she also delivers a side dish for free or a scoop of ice cream, you can be like, all right, well, I'm going to get really fat, but I certainly don't feel like this waitress is threatening to my food in any way, shape, or form. So it is something that I think people need to be aware of and that we want to make sure that we work on. But again, we want to make sure that we're working on it from the standpoint of changing that dog's emotional state and not focusing on just changing the output behavior. And a lot of those sort of things that people say, oh, we'll do this and it will prevent that. You know, putting our hands in their food, taking the food away, giving it back, taking things away, giving them back without any type of voluntary participation on the dog's part. They can make them worse. I certainly see that.
Mm-hmm. And it's such common advice. It makes sense if you don't really think about the emotional state. And the restaurant analogy is perfect. I use it too. Because when people tell you, oh, you have to do this so that your dog realizes it's no threat, it sounds logical. But then when you test it, it's not that logical.
Right.
And if you do, the other thing I tell people, if you're insisting on taking the bowl away from it, make sure when you give it back, it's better than what you took away.
Yes,
so if you're going to pick up the dog's bowl or put your hand in it, make sure that when your hand comes out or you give the bowl back, there's something in there that wasn't in there before, so that the dog gets used to you approaching. And that when we do, that usually means that Julie means chicken. So this is really cool. Come on over here and put some more chicken in my bowl.
Yes.
One thing I did want to ask you too is that in general, I recommend to people that they pick up their puppies between 8 to 10 weeks of age. Mm-hmm. And I was told at one point that research seemed to indicate that dogs learned a lot about bite inhibition from their litter mates around 7 weeks of age. Is that true?
So they start to learn that in their social engagement periods. And in some places, it's illegal to take a puppy away sooner than that for variety of reasons, and some of those are political and some of them are not. But social play and social relationships do seem to go through a peak period from about 6 to 8 weeks of age. There's some suggestion that maybe that's true for dog people social periods, which is why a lot of people want to get their puppies at that time. But that's also the time period where they're sort of most of the wiggly little loose floppy puppy stage, kind of the most effective at moving around. Like they're not quite getting really big yet. They're still made out of rubber. They're not going to hurt themselves, but they do directed motion really pretty well without falling over most of the time, and also do mouthing. And so that's a time period where they do generally start mouthing at each other and at mom. And if we remove them in that time period, how much of that is retained may be variable. I wish we had good comparative studies on it. We certainly know that if you remove them sooner than that, you are more likely to have a variety of social problems, and mouthing is one of them. But I often wonder if the dogs who stay with mom a little bit longer, maybe not to the exclusion of hanging out with people, right? Maybe you get to visit your puppy at age 4 weeks of age and 6 weeks of age and 7 weeks of age and 8 weeks of age, and then you take them home. But we're not very good at teaching bite inhibition as human beings. My canines just suck for that, and I don't want to get fur in my mouth. I don't recommend that as a practice for any reason, right? I can't do the same sorts of body language moves that a mother dog can do. Also, when a puppy bites me, it's much more painful. So I'm far more likely to inadvertently make the exact wrong noise and be stimulatory and rewarding and fun. And so as a small child, than an adult dog is, or even the other puppies. Okay. So it's a balancing act, right? How do we get them so that they really like human beings and we can have all this influence on their socialization period? And how do we also get them to learn to speak dog, given that we humans we can read dog, but we don't always speak dog back.
Right.
And we don't always read dog very well.
Sure, sure. There's a wide degree of capability and effort in that.
Right. And I bring that up because some people are very concerned that their dog is very nippy. And I think there's such a broad range of my dog is mouthy, which my dog should be as a puppy, to my dog is nippy, which can be uncomfortable, to my dog is really sort of aggressively biting. Mm-hmm. And each one of those instances requires a different level of attention. And if the dog is really biting, per se, and drawing blood, then that is probably something that needs to be addressed, because that's not normal behavior, I don't think, in a puppy. Puppies can nip and accidentally draw a little bit of blood, but they shouldn't be aggressively attacking your hand.
Sure. Yeah. And it looks different. Now, the subtleties on how it looks different and how it's different, I think, is what's really challenging. And it's why one of those getting in a puppy class, working with a professional, saying, you know, here's what happens at home when, and is that normal or is that not normal, or how do we address that either way? And if you have a puppy that's just needs to put things in its mouth, because that's part of what it's doing, I mean, they experience the world a lot through that. So if they mouth you and your shoes and the coffee table and their toys, okay, that's probably just we have some direction issues with our mouth and the whole world is just our oyster to put in our mouth. Versus if you do something, right? So you're practicing handling a puppy, or they're in visiting your veterinarian and your veterinarian is looking in their ears and they're turning around going, arr, 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 gnawing it, without the growling sound, I just like the gnawing effect. they're not, you know, gnawing at your veterinarian's wrist and lab coat. But as soon as their veterinarian stops touching their ear, they stop mouthing. Then I get worried that that's an induced stress response, right? I'm trying to cope with this situation.
Okay.
And then, you know, significantly injurious mouthing behavior of any sort, whether it's just because of the intensity, right? They're mouthing all the things in the world, but when they mouth you, they're leaving bruise marks, breaking skin. That's an intensity issue. Or if they're directed, right? There's something happens and then the dog's teeth are making contact with your skin. And then when that's over, it's done and they go back to doing something else. And that's not mouthing. And that's not a part of play behavior. Puppy play can hurt, don't get me wrong.
Yes.
I am not a good golden retriever. So when a puppy plays with me with its mouth, I'm like, ow. But that, there are some of those differences. And I think that's hard to instill in 30 seconds of here's what happened with my puppy, which is why it's really helpful to, you know, see how the other puppies are doing and talk to people who do puppies for a living.
Right, right. Well, that's great. I think that is a pretty good summary of our sort of yellow and red flags. Is there anything that you'd like to add in that somebody should be aware of if they get a new puppy that we haven't touched on that would be a reason why they need to contact somebody for some additional help?
Yeah, I think the one last one is these dogs that we get or we see these puppies that are labeled as stubborn, who won't do something. And sometimes it's something like sit or lie down. And if it's just those, but they do lots of other things well, or they will only not do them in certain situations, then that's something to reach out for help about. I mean, I've met some pretty young dogs who actually do have development of problems in their elbows and hips or their back and their neck, and sit or lie down actually hurts. And that's why they don't want to do it. And maybe when they lie down at home, they just flop on their side. So when we try to lure them the way we do it with their nose down and putting them kind of perfectly in position like this picturesque noble statue, they go, nope, I don't want to do that because that hurts. And so if we're seeing those types of things, like a refusal to do a specific behavior or a refusal to do it in a specific environment, we need to ask ourselves why. And if it's environmental, talk to the person who's helping you, you know, teach your puppy things. And if it's across the board, you know, go see your vet.
Right.
Just make sure. There's no harm in asking that question and making sure.
Because if a puppy's in pain, it's not that I won't. I can't. I literally can't do this. And that's why I try to explain to my owner sometimes if their dogs won't do something that they normally do. Well, this might be a more stressful environment, and your dog is telling you right now, I need a little bit more distance from the stressor. It's not being stubborn. I really can't do it. And if it is indeed physical pain, that can eventually lead to behavior problems as well. So, you know, take care of the underlying organic physical causes, and you're going to either prevent or resolve some behavior problems as well, is what I have found to be true. So,
absolutely.
Good point.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Dr. Lilly. That was a terrific episode on what to look for if your puppy is showing some behavior things that require some attention. And if you do have any questions, I think you would agree that one of the best things to do is look for a positive reinforcement trainer who can help you begin to evaluate this, maybe one who specializes in puppies and who has some connections to people that may have their master's or their PhD or whatever in behavior, so that if something gets more serious, you've got some resources. But a good place to start is always a positive reinforcement trainer. So,
absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And we will talk next time. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Your Family Dog. Got questions? Interesting ideas? Colleen and Julie would love to hear them. Call 614-349-1661 or visit www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com to share your thoughts.